Well, good morning. We are starting a new Sunday school series and doing so with a new set of decorations that you're all going to be tempted to stare at instead of what's on the screen or what's in front of you in your notes. So we'll do our best to focus together. Thankfully, we have a subject matter that, if we think about it carefully, is far more interesting and deep and joy-filled than anything else that we can experience in this life. So we're going to be talking about, for the rest of this summer, God willing, on the doctrine of God. I'll be teaching this week, next week. Pastor Greg will be teaching a few weeks while I'm gone in Liberia. Then I'll come back and finish up the series. So he'll be teaching on the series as well. So this is on the doctrine of God. You'll also see at the top of your handout that this is also what we would call the subject of theology proper. If you're not familiar with that term, theology itself, the word theos is the Greek word for God. That's where you get the thea at the beginning of that word. And ology is knowledge. It's a Greek word for knowledge. So when you talk about theology, we're talking about a knowledge of God. And we say that generally about all subjects of God and the Bible, but here, specifically, we're talking about the direct study of the person of God himself. So that's why it's called theology proper. It focuses on that specific study. All right? So that's what we're going to be talking about. And I just want to say also at the beginning that there is no possible way we're going to cover every question you have about God in approximately, I think it's like 11 weeks, something like that. And especially when we only have about 35 to 40 minutes each session. So we're not going to cover everything there is to know about God. We're going to give you a little bit more than a really basic course, a little bit less than a really deep course, I would say it that way. But I hope that it will be an opportunity for you to grow as a Christian, to grow in your knowledge of who God is, maybe answer some questions, and honestly, I hope that it will also cause you to have a whole bunch more questions that you'll have a thirst to begin studying and answering for yourself. Now, with that said, let's jump into our notes as we think about this matter of the person of God. And just by way of introduction, just want to say a little bit about doing theology in general. Two types of theologians. There are two types of theologians. There are those who don't really care, and there are those who are deliberate about their theology. Now, here I'm speaking specifically to Christians. Everybody actually is a theologian. Every person on planet Earth has thoughts about God. Some of their thoughts are good thoughts, some of their thoughts are incomplete thoughts. Some of their thoughts are misguided thoughts. Some of their thoughts might be great thoughts. Every person on planet Earth has thoughts about the person of God. Now, Christians, more specifically, they have an obligation and a duty to know something about God. But even among Christians, unfortunately, there are some people who have thoughts about God, who are Christians, but they don't really care and they don't really think much about him. And then there are those who are deliberate about their theology. Now, my goal is to help you to become that second kind of theologian, somebody who's thinking rightly about God. And that I want you to be a deliberate thinker about God. And along that line of being a deliberate thinker, there are three levels of someone who's a deliberate theologian. First, there is someone, as we think about these three levels, there is someone who can give the answers. Someone who can give the answers. This is the person that when you ask them a question, they can spout off an answer that they've learned in a class or a book or through personal study. Can you tell me what is the Trinity? Well, the Trinity is the fact that there is one God who exists in three persons. Those persons are not the same persons, but they are the same God. Be a pretty simple answer. They can give that kind of an answer. How powerful is God? God is all-powerful. There's no limit to his power except by his own nature. It would be an answer. And those are true answers. So they know something about it. And that's one level of a deliberate theologian. A second level of a deliberate theologian is someone who realizes that there are not just a bunch of theological facts, but that they are all interconnected. So they give the answers and they start to realize that how you answer one question about the person of God affects another part of who God is. So if you answer about something about the knowledge of God here, it might have implications for what God does over there. You might think of it as like a web or a spider web. And if you went on one side of the web, I know it's gross, some of you are creeped out already just thinking about touching a spider web, but if you went and you did and you pulled just on one side of the web, just a little bit, one string, it doesn't just affect that one string. It pulls the whole thing a little bit. And when you start talking about God, how you define and answer things, you start to realize that what you say about God over here has implications for what we think about God over there. And we'll explore a little bit about that. That's a second level of a deliberate theologian. That's someone who's gone a little bit further than just giving the answers. And then the final level of a deliberate theologian is this. This is someone who understands that the interconnected system makes a difference in life. Makes a difference in life. This person sees the beauty of the system and worships God for it. I think this is where every person who wants to think seriously, be a deliberate theologian, wants to be. And furthermore, they see that how they should be think, it says thing there, I think, think about God affects how they live. So that really is where I want to get you all a little bit further in our class. I don't want you to just to be able to give the answers about God, although that's important. I hope for some of you, maybe for the first time, you'll start to see the whole of God in his understanding of him and see how we understand him over here relates to how he is over there. I hope that will be true. But even more than that, really, I hope that as you know something about God, it will lead you to worship him. Because as we learn about what he is like and what he is in his essence, in his nature, in his attributes, and his relationships to the world around us, we discover that he is actually worthy of our adoration, our praise, our worship. And when we know him and know him as he is, it actually changes the way that we do life. And that's where we want to go. All right, so that's just a brief introduction. There's a lot more I could say about what we do with theology and understanding about that, but just want to have that in the back of your mind. This is an opportunity for us, if we do it right, to worship God and have him change the way that we live. Now, we're going to start in a little bit more of an academic exercise, and that is we're going to just think about some theories about God or the gods. So we have, as Bible-believing Christians, a very specific way in which we understand the person of God. But of course, we have only one view among many. We believe, the correct view and the righteous view. But when we talk about God, there are competing ideas that creep up into people's minds, including in some of the list of things we're going to go through here, sometimes that do affect Christians because of cultural norms and pressures around us. Okay, so I'm going to tick off through these fairly quickly. I'm not going to try to answer extensive questions on these, but at least give you a flavor of some of the theories about God or the gods, right? First of all, there is some people would believe in what we call animism. Animism teaches that everything is alive with spirits that can help or injure man or mankind. So everything around you has various spirits in them. And this is a very ancient form of religion. It exists in a few places in the world today. It's less seen in the world today, but in some tribal religions, you would still find forms of this today. That's animism. For instance, in parts of Africa, Asia, Papua New Guinea, for instance, where Cynthia McGuire is, we support her in Papua New Guinea, she would face these kinds of things probably if we'd asked her. There are people who see spirits as in certain objects. Actually, even in Minnesota, some of the Ojibwe would describe their religious experiences in forms of animism. There in the 1970s, there was a guy who did extensive study on the Ojibwe, otherwise known as Chippewa Indians, and did extensive study on them, and he noted that they have animistic tendencies among their religion. So they would talk about humans as one kind of persons, but they would also describe rock persons and eagle persons and river persons. So there's spirits that exist within them. So it does actually exist in at least a minor form around us today. Also, shamanism is another form of this as well. A shaman interacts with the spiritual world and uses those spirits to influence our physical world. That's around us as well. So that's one theory about God. A second one is dynamism. Dynamism is the belief in impersonal life energy, which can be used for evil or for good. And this life energy pervades all things. Can anybody think of a very popular expression of this?
May the force be with you.
Da, 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 yeah. Bum, 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 bum. Yes, right? The force is with you, right? May the force be with you. There's this life force that exists. Some of it's good, some of it's bad, and we need to tap into that. Now, that's a popularized view of it in Star Wars, and most people like me who happen to be a Star Wars fan think nothing of that. But there are people who actually have this kind of view, you know, that there's kind of this cosmic force that we can kind of tap into. Letter C, here's another theory about God or the gods, and that is fetishism. This view believes that a spirit can temporarily dwell in an inanimate object, and the object is therefore worshipped because the god or some other power is there. Sometimes, in fact, even oftentimes, these objects are man-made. People who believe this think that these powers can come and go from these objects. This, by the way, you might think this is crazy, but this is making a comeback in various ways. This is one of them. There is an incredible obsession today that is growing with like crystals and stones. It's people thinking that they have some sort of power in them, that have spiritual power. And if you want to see an example of that, you don't have to go far. Anybody know that there's a store around here that has people that sell that kind of stuff and they're really popular? Anybody know what I'm talking about?
It's Taylor's Falls.
Yes, Taylor's Falls. There's a rock shop right down there and it's loaded with this kind of thing. Now, I'll say there's also a lot of really cool rocks in there. So if you just like rocks, I have no problem with you going in there. And they have wonderful little, like if you're looking for a charm to go on your necklace, like they have every possible thing that you can imagine. It's incredible. But there's also this vibe in there that's pretty clear if you go in that it's this kind of thing, that there are actually powers that exist in some of these things that can ward off spirits or have spirits attract to you through them. And so this is a thing. Various forms of Wiccans, which is also growing, engage in this kind of thing as well. Even forms of voodooism, that we somehow like use objects that are man-made that create certain powers that spirits indwell. These are on the rise. So this is it's not a major thing. It's still a very minor thing in our culture, but it's a fast-growing minority. Another theory about the gods is idolatry. Idolatry is similar to fetishism, except that the spirit of the god permanently indwells the sacred object. thus the object is always sacred. There are various forms of idolatry. In monolatry, the worshiper selects one god or idol among many and worships it. Other people see we have a pantheon of gods that I might select several of them that are my gods. Or more likely in idolatry is I have this god here, but maybe for some reason I change from worshiping exclusively that god to another god. We see especially in the Old Testament. It exists less in its pure form today. But think about some of the nations that surrounded the people of Israel. You had Chemosh of the Moabites, Moloch, Baal, Marduk. These were all gods that demanded worship. Another theory about the gods is polytheism. Polytheism is the worship of more than one god. One of the world's major religions engages in this explicitly. Hinduism would do this, right? A number of years ago, I was driving down. I'd gone to a camp, a family camp, and then my brother was getting married. And while we were at the end of that camp, we had somebody in the church who passed away. And my family needed to go to the wedding. I was going to get there in time, but I was coming back for the funeral. And so I took a bus from southern Wisconsin up to Minneapolis, and then eventually took another bus back down to southern Wisconsin to get there in time for my brother's wedding. And when I went on the way back, it was a late night ride, and I rode the Megabus. You know, you've seen the ads for those. I think they're still around. Maybe not. All right, Megabus, and they got a direct line from St. Paul, I think, or Minneapolis, can't even remember anymore, down to Madison. And so I got on at, you know, it was like 10 o'clock at night, and I paid to upgrade to get a little table. And the idea was I could do some work while I was on this bus. Let me just tell you, if you ever are on those, it's not worth it. The table is like literally this big, and it's shared with three other people. So I did not feel like I had any more space. And plus, you're facing the two people that are across from you, so like there's barely enough room for one laptop. And I was surrounded by three ladies. The lady across from me is someone who I would call Minnesota mom. Oh yeah, you betcha. She was, you know, she was going down to see her daughter that was studying at the University of Wisconsin. She's really nice. And then next to her was Asian mom, who I think spoke plenty of English, but played dumb like she didn't, and just listened to the conversation and pretended she slept the whole time. And then there was Hindu mom that was next to me over here, and she actually was commuting back and forth for work. She went and worked 3 days a week down in Madison, and then came back up where her husband worked in Minneapolis. So this is a few years ago where the Zoom revolution hadn't really taken hold. And so we had some interesting conversations, and they found out I was a pastor, and eventually realized that I wasn't going to get any work done, so we just talked and got to share the gospel a little bit, and not too far. But one of the interesting things was I talked to this Hindu lady, and I was asking about her husband, and they actually had the classic Indian thing where they never met until the day before of their wedding. Their families arranged their marriage. They both flew from the United States to India, met on a Friday, and got married on a Saturday. So that's how they got married, and they had been married like 8-10 years, something like that. They were doing well, and so I was asking about their family, and it was just interesting conversation. And I noticed that on her screen, as she hit with her phone, there was a picture of this gold ornate monstrosity. Right? You've all seen Hindu gods or goddesses before, and I knew what that was. And I just asked her. I said, "What's that?" And she pointed up and said, "This is my god." And that's what it was. This is my god. And I said, "Well, tell me about that." And so, you know, this is my family's God. This is the one that we worship in our family for generations. And I said, "It's the only God." No, there's lots of other gods and all of that. She begins to describe the Hindu religion, and it opened up some pathways to conversation. She had some questions about Christianity she didn't understand. And we were able to talk a little bit. She didn't get saved or anything like that, but it was a good, helpful interaction. But that she was a polytheist, right? It's you know, there's a whole bunch of gods. Because I asked her, I said, is this the only god you worship? No, we kind of worship others as well, but this is kind of our main one, represents our family. And so this is alive and well in our world today. So that's another view of the gods. Moving on, monotheism. Monotheism is the belief in and worship of one God or supreme being. There are three primary monotheistic religions in the world today: Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. In, of course, biblical thought, in Christian thought, and even Judeo-Christian thought, God is personal. God is personal and ethical. He's distinct from the world, yet has immanence in it, and he's the creator and sustainer of all things, and he's revealed himself in many ways. That would especially be true in Christianity and forms of Judaism, and even to a certain degree true in forms of Islam as well. Just a couple of more quickly. Deism. Deism is another one. Deism is the belief in one God who does not participate in the events of the world. So the classic way of talking about deism is God created everything kind of like a clockmaker creates a clock, winds it up, and lets it go. That'd be a deistic view of the world. Such a God is actually very seldom worshipped, since he cannot be reached through prayer and does not influence the world directly. It's only indirectly. Deists will even use words like providence. This is why men like Thomas Jefferson or Benjamin Franklin would talk about the providence of God, but they didn't mean the same thing that we mean. They would talk just in general of how God has ordered things and let it go. And in that sense, we could worship a God who made all this, and they would have thought that God made things so that the world is actually getting better. Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson kind of had that view that progress was inevitable because of the way God structured the world. So they would talk. And it was very common in the 17 and early 1800s. Lots and lots of leading thinkers around the world were deists, or at least heavily influenced by them. It's less popular today, partly because World War I and World War II kind of crushed the idea of deism being a really good thing, because it's like, well, if God just wound things up and let it go, that doesn't sound really good. I have a suspicion, like most of these things, it'll come back in time again. Just give enough time, these things tend to repeat. And then finally, dualism. I said two more. I actually have three more, don't I? Dualism. Dualism is the belief in two principles or gods who are locked in eternal conflict. Never going to be a winner. Various forms of Chinese philosophy engage in this. Think yin and yang. Also, classic Egyptian gods. For instance, if you're familiar with the gods Seth and Osiris, Seth was violent. He was connected with disorder and barrenness. Osiris was active in the waters of the Nile and promoted fertility. And then these two gods were always at war with each other, and at times when there's a famine, it looked like Seth is prevailing, and then when there's richness and blessing and fertility, then Osiris is prevailing, but they go back and forth eternally. Pantheism. Pantheism is a belief that God is all, and God is in all, and all is God. All reality is God. Nothing exists but God. Everything is a manifestation of God. God is actually locked into the universe. Now, this is different than animism in that there are not multiple spirits or powers. Rather, God is in everything. Whereas animism would say that there are spirits that are in certain objects. Here, God is in all things, everywhere. You find this more in some forms of Eastern religions. Now here's the most basic Sunday school question that you could ever get in your life. Which of the above is the correct viewpoint? Class? Monotheism. Okay. We're going to try to articulate that a little bit more. But monotheism is what we would hold to. The God of the Bible is exclusively monotheistic. Now, let's talk a little bit about the existence of God. The existence of God. As we think about the existence of God, it'd be helpful for us to define him a little bit. And you'll see this in your notes. Many theologians have defined God this way. God is the infinite and perfect spirit in whom all things have their source, support, and end. Another statement, a classic one, the Westminster Catechism states it this way, and I think the Second London Baptist Confession, there we go, would state it, I think, very similarly. God is a spirit, infinite, eternal, unchangeable in his being, wisdom, power, holiness, justice, goodness, and truth. Those are some classic definitions in a simple sentence of the person of God. And we're going to explore that a little bit more, obviously, but that would be a simple way of defining who God is. Let's talk just a little bit about the assumption of God's existence. The assumption of God's existence. The Bible begins and ends with the assertion and assumption of God's existence. Begins and ends with the assertion and assumption of God's existence. Got here in your verses or in your notes that classic verse that everybody knows if you've been in Sunday school for your life, right? Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God. That's just how the Bible starts. It just says God exists. He is assumed to exist. It simply declares to man, and this is actually an important phrase, what he already knows, what mankind already knows in his heart, that God is. God is. We'll explore this a little bit more here in a second. The Bible has no formal arguments or proofs for God's existence, although there is abundant biblical proof of his existence, but it doesn't have formal proofs of it. In the Bible, the only form of atheism found in the Bible is practical atheism. Practical atheism. And here we quote, you note there, Psalm 14, verse 1, and Psalm 53, verse 1. And those verses say, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God, or no God. The fool says in his heart, there is no God. Now, does that mean that the Bible doesn't accept or doesn't believe that anybody is a true atheist? Yes and no. The key in Psalm 14 and also Psalm 53, if you read through those texts, is that the fool is someone who actually is working to practically suppress how God relates to his or her life right now. Just tries to push him out of existence for how I think, how I act, and what I do. When it says there is no God, it's possible that the fool there is denying the existence of God absolutely, but it more likely shows that the fool is denying the existence of God relative to my life now. This, by the way, is one of the classic problems for atheists today, is that they have to describe themselves not in a positive way, but in a negative way. You actually have to say actively, I don't believe that there is a God. And as soon as you're doing that, of course, you're conjuring up images of a God or the God. I would actually argue that, this is not for this class, but I would actually argue that there aren't really true atheists. They actually have to work to suppress the knowledge of God around them. That's for another ethics and philosophy class on that, if it's fast.
To just kick off the verse you just used, when Scripture says in Romans chapter 1, when they were unwilling to retain God in their knowledge, he gave them over to a reprobate mind, and that is the definition of a fool.
Yeah, and we're going to actually go to that text here in just a second, because that's I think, what the Bible actually shows. All right? So the fool is one who chooses to think, not to think of God as being involved with their daily life. daily life. Now, to Todd's point, this is exactly where we're going. It's in the notes as well. Everyone knows that God exists. This is an innate thing that people have to suppress. So if you got your Bibles, let's go over to Romans chapter 1. Romans chapter 1. And can I do the terrible thing of borrowing somebody's Bible because somehow, and I have a feeling I know which little fingers did that, they deleted my Bible app off of my iPad. So can I borrow somebody's Bible? Because I'm using my phone to run the PowerPoint, so. Thank you, little fingers. All right. She's really cute, so I'm pretty sure that's the one who did that, because she's the one that likes to play on Dad's iPad. So, all right, we're in Romans 1, and we're going to look at verse 18. This is the beginning of Paul's gospel, and it starts with negative news. It says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men," and this phrase is important, "who suppress the truth in unrighteousness." They hold it down. They don't want to let it affect their thinking, and they don't want to let it affect their lives. Now, Paul then explains a little bit more about this form of suppressing the truth, verse 19. "Because," or "since, what may be known of God is manifest," that means clearly seen, "in them, for God has shown it to them." How, Paul, how, God, have you shown your existence to people? Paul explains again with another explanatory word, verse 20. "For," or "because, since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes," his invisible nature, his character, his invisible person, they're clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made. And here's the invisible things that are seen in his created order. "Even his eternal power and Godhead," or the nature of God, "so that they are without excuse." Because, verse 21, "although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were they thankful. Their thoughts became futile, their foolish hearts were darkened. They professed to be wise," and just as the psalmist in Psalm 14 says, and Todd was correctly making the jump here, "they became fools." So the fool is someone who actively suppresses the clear knowledge of God and who he is and in his person. Thank you, Scott. I'm not trying to be harsh here, but this is patently true. You know, you look around at our world today, and there are a lot of supposedly very sophisticated people who are declaring themselves to be atheists today. And, and they're really smart, right? Some of them are really, 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 really smart. But in all of their smartness, they actually have major, major gaps in their thinking. Like, look around in this room. Where did this come from? And they give really sophisticated answers that when you actually drill down to the end of their sophistication, they're bankrupt theories. And they require just as much faith as anybody who believes in an eternal God. And you see this, right? So there's a famous clip, you can go find it, of Richard Dawkins, the British atheist, really famous guy, of him interacting in a forum about where matter came from. And he gives this answer saying that scientifically, it comes from nothing. And he actually tries to argue that nothing can create something. But the way in which he does that is to redefine the word nothing to be something. And the interviewer is pushing back on him and saying, no. And he gives us really, and it's not because like somehow he's really smart and he understands something about nothing that we don't. It's a bankrupt system. You know, other people just say, well, there's just matter has always been here. That leaves that person with so many unanswered questions, it is unbelievable. You have to make giant leaps of faith. And I say this because in our world today, people who believe publicly in an exclusive God, like the God of the Bible, and even true also for Muslims today or people of the Jewish persuasion, people who do that, they're often ridiculed as being stupid and foolish. And I would just push back and say, well, I'm really not sure it's that stupid to think that something made this. Just don't think it's that dumb. And furthermore, beyond that, when I think about the answers that others give, I find them horribly bankrupt. They don't actually answer really basic questions. And their systems lead to all sorts of, quite frankly, depressing things. And this fits exactly with what Paul said back in Romans 1. And by the way, if you say, well, that's because Paul didn't know the sophistication of today, go read the Greek philosophers that Paul interacted with. There were plenty of people back then in the first century who said that there wasn't a supreme being or God. All right, atheism is not a new thing. It's just got kind of a revitalization these days, and there's a growing chorus of it. Paul interacted with that just plenty back then, yeah.
When we redefine atheism, make it more clear, be more like agnosticism.
Yeah, that's a more popular form of it, is agnosticism would just say, I can't know much about God. But Paul would equally say that's a foolish thing in this text, because he would say, you can at least know this, there is a God, and that God, whatever he, she, it is awfully powerful. So even that, agnosticism, may have the veneer of intellectual sophistication, but it's a sham, it's a veneer. Because you're still denying something that should be patently obvious. And furthermore, I'll just say this. It's the agnostics and the atheists who are actually out of step with the rest of the world and culture. Even in America today, where secularism seems to reign on the television in so many ways and all forms of media, if the polling is unbelievably high, that the overwhelming majority, 80+% of people in America believe exclusively in a God or gods, like some of the definitions we give here. And furthermore, even of the remaining, it's like less than 20% of them, most of them would acknowledge that there probably is something out there of some power or godlike thing. So don't be fooled into thinking that everybody is like all against us on this. So the Bible just says God's here, and the Bible claims it's foolish to deny the existence of God. That's clear both from Psalm 14, Psalm 53, and also Romans 1, and I think it actually fits in the way the world actually works. Well, I'm just about out of time, and I don't want to jump into the rational proofs of God's existence. You can bring those notes back next week, and we'll get into this. I do promise that we will get more into the person of God in the weeks to come. We'll spend just a little bit of time next week talking about some ways people have tried to prove the existence of God, and then we'll get into God's nature and person. Yes, sir.
Where does basins fit in the first section of theories? Where would you place them in the different theories of God? The Masonic Lodge.
I don't know the answer to that question. Maybe you do. So.
Maybe I do.
Yeah, I'm serious. I don't. I mean, I'm here. This is my total nerdiness coming out. I'm remembering a number of years ago, I read, slogged through Tolstoy's War and Peace. I didn't understand most of it. But there's a main character in there who gets involved with the Masons, and in him, he's trying to bring his theistic worldview in with the Masons. But that's about the extent of what I know on that. So.
They would probably fall most under deists. Some of them, I think, would agree that there's a God, but they think that they're in control of what's going on here, and they take control of what's here, and they just do the thing. But I would say that they probably are more deistic than anything.
Yeah, it's good. You're probably right. I have it somewhere in the recesses of my brain. I've done study on the Masons, and it's at 10, 11 this morning. It's not coming back to me, but that sounds right. So, yeah. Well, let's have a quick word of prayer, and then we'll get ready for the morning service. Father, I thank you for this opportunity we've had to begin to think about you, and also to even just think about your glory in the creation of all things, and it is displayed. The beautiful sunrise this morning reminds us of your eternal Godhead and nature and power. And you are a powerful God. I pray that we would learn through this study to worship you as such. And we pray these things in Christ's name. Amen. Thanks so much.